This talk is given by Vanessa Zuise Goddard, a writer and lay teacher based in Panama City, Panama. Zuise is also the guiding teacher of the Ocean Mind Sangha, a virtual community of Zen practitioners. And this talk, like all of her talks, is offered freely. If you'd like to offer a donation to support Zuise's work, listen to other talks, or find out more about the Ocean Mind Sangha, please visit us at oceanmindsangha.org. Thanks for listening.
May we purify an ocean of worlds. May we free an ocean of beings. May we see an ocean of Dharma. May we realize an ocean of wisdom. May we purify an ocean of activities. May we fulfill an ocean of aspirations. May we make offerings to an ocean of Buddhas. May we practice without discouragement for an ocean of eons. Good morning. So today we are doing Dharma Encounter, Shosan, and with it concluding our 2025 Spring Ango. This is our fourth Ango as a Sangha, as the Ocean Mind Sangha, after roughly a little more, actually, I think more like 5 years of practicing together. And, you know, when I think about how that's evolved, part of me is constantly surprised, and part of me is constantly reaffirmed, you know, of the power of aspiration, really, of the power of a group of people coming together. And not just a common goal, but, you know, facing in the same direction and wanting to make something of this life. And so it is thanks to your practice and your aspiration that I can be here, certainly, that we can all be here. And that's not a small thing, as my teacher used to say all the time. Shosan means, sho means little or small, and san is a meeting or a consultation. So it's a brief public meeting with a teacher, right? So daisan is the private meeting with a teacher, and Shosan gives us the opportunity to see a little bit more, you know, how that relationship works, that teacher-student relationship works, how a teacher works with students, how students work to integrate and express the Dharma. And so it's a wonderful way to learn how we're growing, both as individuals and as a Sangha. Because so much of our practice is private, right? Even though we're doing this together, what happens in Daisan is private. Certainly what happens in your mind, well, that's not actually quite private, because we're constantly communicating. And we see that in Sesshin, right? So clearly, especially when it's close quarters like this, we're constantly showing where our minds are, where our bodies are. And that's a good thing, so that we can continue to move through a space, to move through life, to move through the world in a way that is awake. And so Dharma Encounter evolved in Song Dynasty China as a way for teachers and students to meet and to learn from one another. And over time, it took on a very ritualized character. So in Japan, and to this day, in certain places in Japan, the way that it's done is the question, the theme that the teacher is going to bring up is known beforehand, and the answers that the students give are formalized, and so they're set answers. And so it's a bit more of a performance, but still, it's You know, sometimes when we used to speak of it, when I was growing up in the Dharma, we would always kind of disparage that. You know, that it's a ritual. Everything is set, is rehearsed. But I've been reflecting on that, and you know, the fact that sometimes we have to hear things over and over and over again. And so I imagine that Dharma encounter was a way to, yet another way to bring across the teachings, the authentic, the correct teachings, if you will. And if you were a monastic who was doing Dharma encounter, you know, every month during Ango, you were hearing the same things over and over again. And at a certain point, hopefully, they become your insight. They become your words. They become your understanding. So I don't think it's all negative that it was all that it was ritualized. But the way that that I was trained, the way that I learned, was that it was a more spontaneous encounter. So you don't know what I'm going to talk about. I don't know what you're going to say, which in a more accurate way reflects what happens in Daisan, what happens in a private meeting. And it makes it very real and very immediate. And that is, you know, perhaps one of the more transportable aspects of the Dharma, right? Because if it only worked here in this setting, in Sesshin, you know, then what would be the use of it in your life? But the ability to respond in each moment is exactly what gives us the strength, the fortitude, the resilience to respond in our lives. And also because once you see something for yourself, no one can take that from you. You know, it's one thing for me to repeat the Dharma time and time again and for you to take it in. But when you see it, no one can take that from you. And then that's how you can take it and use it in all sorts of circumstances in your life. And so, many of you know, recently I have been reflecting and speaking a bit about practice and training and the difference between the two. And so my teacher, Daito Roshi, used to say, practice is what you do, and training is what happens to you. And so practice is what you do in the privacy of your own mind, what you do on your cushion, what you do as you're moving through your life, and you're taking these profound teachings, the Buddha Dharma, and integrating it in your lives. You practice being with the breath, you practice the precepts, you practice the paramitas, the four vows. You practice returning when you've become distracted. Training is what we do together. I ask one of you to be Jikiro. I ask one of you to be Shuso. I ask one of you to make food. And you respond by fulfilling this role. And, you know, often, or at least sometimes, we don't feel ready, right, for what we're being asked to do. And so this aspect of stretching, of having to step forward in a way that you might not know how, to me, is what empowers us. You think to yourself, I can't, I can't, I can't, I can't. And then I say, yes, you can. You step forward, you do it, and you realize, oh, okay, I can. And you stretch a little more. And this is how we grow. And in a way, it's a little bit like the tension between practice and aspiration. You know, so we practice always according to our capacity and according to our wish, according to our intention. But aspiration makes us reach. If you go to the gym, most of us will just do what we know and what is comfortable up to a certain point. If you get a trainer, the trainer will ask you to do things that some that you don't even want to do, you don't think you're capable of doing. And then you do it and you stretch. And it's very much like that in the Dharma. That's why we practice together. That's why we work with a teacher. And so, you know, again, reflecting on a weekend like this, what it took to make this happen. Yesterday, as we were doing Orioki, which, by the way, I mean, give us one more day and we'd be experts at it. It's incredible how in 2 days, I wasn't sure how it would work because I knew we didn't have any of the serving implements and it just flowed beautifully. So I looked down the row and I actually got choked up and I thought, here we are. Here we are doing it. And this is how it is. This is how it works. You know, I say, you know, can somebody sign up, you know, to cook? And all of you step forward. I said yesterday, I mean, the food was incredible. It was really incredible. Those of you who brought the flowers, the beautiful flower arrangements that we have, that put the altars together, that made my tea in the afternoon. And this is how we respond in our lives. We do this when it's easy or easier, you know, in a group of noble friends that we know, you know, we make a mistake, somebody will be there, they'll reach up and they'll pull you. They'll help you if you don't know. They'll encourage you if you get tired. Like Songkai, who's 86 years old and was doing the schedule at home while we were all sitting here practicing. And so I know it would have been easier in some ways, more comfortable, you know, to get a place and we pay a bit more, they cook for us, and it is not the same. We made this happen. Just like in our lives, you know, no one will make them happen for us. We make them happen. And what I have seen, because most of the time, you know, we practice online, we practice virtually, and you know, now and then somebody brings up a concern. I was concerned for some time. What I saw time and time again, what I continue to see, is that a screen is no barrier when it comes to aspiration. That as long as you want to practice, it is not a problem to have a screen. It is not a problem that we don't see each other all the time. It makes this so much sweeter, for sure. It makes this so much more important. It makes, hopefully, us appreciate it more. But each one of you has been showing me over these years how much you want to do this, how much you want to practice, how much you want to be clear. And I see you changing. And so I'm no longer worried about the fact that we practice on Zoom. Sometimes I don't even remember, to be honest with you. I have you in front of me, I don't even remember that there's a screen. And so we're using these forms, you know, which the Buddha couldn't possibly have imagined. You know, Zoom, Calendly. We use them as opportunities. And also in this way, you know, how we practice this weekend, because in making this happen together, we do make it happen together. You know, we don't just come and receive. I said this before. Because this really is our vow. I know I speak of this a lot because it's so important. You know, to not get small. of course, sometimes we will be overwhelmed. Our lives will demand much of us. And so maybe we can just stretch a little bit. That's okay. That's okay. No one can realize themselves by themselves. No one, not even the Buddha. All the many years, all the many training, all the many people that got him to the point where he saw what he needed to see, and he said, what had to be done has been done. And so we are waking up together. And so my questions to you for this morning. Thich Nhat Hanh once said that it's possible that the next Buddha won't be an individual. He said it might take the form of a community practicing understanding, practicing loving kindness, a community practicing mindful living. And then he said, and the practice can be carried out as a group, as a city, as a nation. And so what does this mean to you, that the next Buddha might not be a person but a Sangha? What does it mean to you now as you practice with this Sangha? And then what does it mean then to realize that Buddha? What role does this Sangha play in your waking up? Maybe particularly now with everything that is happening in the world. And what does that waking up look like on the ground, day to day? And so the way that it will work is Komyo will come up first. So you'll come over to this seat here in front of me. You'll just do a standing bow and then take your seat. We have a handheld mic. If you could, please just hold that close to you so that as we're recording, we can hear the your comments or your questions. And then when you leave, I will say, may your life go well. You do another standing bow, and then you return to your seat. There is no set order. You're welcome to come, anyone who would like to. You know, just remember that this is how we polish one another. This is how we help each other wake up. So don't think about it too much. Don't worry about it. Let's actually meet in this way. All right. Kaito, can I bother you with a little bit of water, please? Just warm water. As you would like.
I am so filled with love for the Sangha. How can that not be the Buddha? I take that love with me everywhere I go. That love holds me up. I take refuge in that love.
And so what do you do with all the people who are not here? People who you might not particularly choose to be with? People that you might have difficulty with, people that you might have aversion with, too. So what do you do with them?
I hold space for them.
How?
By not slandering them, by not killing them in my heart.
Okay. May your life go well. Yes, you put it down, just standing back. Thank you.
Sensei, I live my life in a way that a lot of might find as retreating, ignoring.
Why? How come?
I don't read the news. I don't have TV. I don't have any media external things that come into me about the world. But I say to my wife all the time, I don't need to read the news to know what's going on.
And so what do you do about what's going on?
I stumble through the dark trying to hear the cries of the world. But there's a cacophony of madness that fills my ears, and I bump everything I bump into in that dark eye. I despise, I get angry at, and I don't know how to find my way out and hear those who need to be heard and lift those who need to be lifted.
Well, lifted from where to where?
From oppression to freedom to liberation.
But why would you have to lift them?
Because it's my vow.
Is your vow to lift someone from here to there?
No, my vow is to save them.
And how do you save all beings? How do you save this being here right now?
By turning inward?
No, there's a being here in front of you.
Oh, I'm sorry, I misunderstood.
This being right now. Look at that. May your life go well.
Thank you. Thank you for your teaching.
And if someone needs to come up with a chair, maybe Kaito, you can just have a chair nearby.
Sensei, is this on?
Yes. Hello.
Hello. In the laughter, in the tears, in the boredom, in the fear, in feeling vulnerable, in the anger, in the judgment, in the kindness, in the love, we are now the Buddha. We were yesterday. We will be tomorrow. We are now the Buddha.
That is correct. And what about those times when it really doesn't feel that way? Where it feels, that feels so distant, is you can't feel it, you don't have access to it. What do we do then?
Remember that it passes, another thing comes, and that whatever we feel, we are still the Buddha. Bodhicitta is still in our heart.
Remember that when you're riding the subway. I know how much you love the subway. Remember when you're riding the subway and you have that person in your face. They too are a Buddha.
Very hard. But not impossible. Because it's my mind.
Yes, exactly. May your life go well.
Thank you. Thank you for your teaching.
How do we create a community of Buddhas? Community is so important to me. Thank you for teaching me how to be generous.
I didn't do that.
I know, but I think I felt so locked inside of myself that I couldn't express myself well. But through the practice, I've realized that we all have something to give and offer. And without our offering, we can't receive what is present in the moment. So now everywhere I go, no matter what I'm doing, I try to be present with the experience I'm having and to offer myself to what is before me in whatever way it shows up, even if it's difficult, even if I'm having difficult emotions. The most important thing is to be with what is there in front of me.
Right.
And so to build a community, it requires me to be with others, no matter where I am, what I'm doing, in the supermarket, at work, on the cushion. And that's the way to build it. One person at a time, one flower at a time.
Yeah. And this is why this kind of thing is such a great practice for that. We've been saying how in this space, in the silence, in the stillness, everything becomes magnified. It doesn't even become magnified. We just see it more, right? Because we're not moving so fast. We're not talking to ourselves all the time. And so we feel the annoyance. Oh, this person, is breathing loud. Oh, I love everyone. And we see the emotions changing, like sometimes second by second. And we see ourselves responding, and we see how we can create suffering in that instant and how we can put it down and how it is actually our choice, right? That's what I said yesterday. Mm-hmm. We can't control what happens to us, but we can always choose how to respond. And, there are many things in our lives that we would rather be otherwise. Yesterday, I was telling some people, in the 15 minutes before Fusatsu, I was like, let me put on a nicer shirt, so I change. I'm like, I'm going to go to the restroom before we begin. I go to the restroom, and the toilet is clogged, and it's filled. And I'm like, nobody told me. And so I have a choice, do I just turn around and hope somebody will take care of it? So I like roll up my sleeves. I'm like plunging the toilet. Then I come out, and I'm doing Fusatsu. And I'm like, this is actually a pretty good metaphor for the work that I do. unclog the drain to let the shit flow through. So we just respond. Kurt mentioned, hearing the cries of the world. Avalokiteshvara, the one who hears the cries of the world, is not dramatic. It's not, you don't come in your horse with a flowing mane and your spear. It's, you unclog the toilet. You pick up the trash. You get another trash bag, you prepare a meal. Most of the time, really, it is very basic. Because we see what's happening in the world and it all feels so large, and it is large, but then we're like, then I can't do anything. We can always, always do something. We can always do something. And so the question is, what do I do? What good shall I offer, shall I do today? May your life go well.
Sensei. For many years, I practiced alone, and I knew there was something missing. I had family.
How did you know?
I felt it. I attended zendos of various kinds, and I saw there was something there that I wasn't getting, and I didn't know how to access it. I had family, I had friends who were individuals, and I loved them, and they provided me a lot of satisfaction. And then I joined this community, this Sangha, and it's like, ah, I get it. It's individuals, but it's more than individuals. And that sense of community that starts with the Sangha has spread out in my life to include my friends and family, and has spread out even more. And I feel like the community that will be Buddha, or that is Buddha, is humanity itself. And yet I have an issue or a problem in that expanding community with, I guess, a class of people who even here seem to be exceptions to the rule of loving everyone. There are political leaders. And that's something I don't know what to do about.
So you mean that you feel that the difficulty in loving everyone? Yes.
Yes.
I think we all go through that. You know, that's the challenge, I think, of loving kindness. You know, we hear loving kindness, we hear the metta teachings, and they feel all kind of soft and fluffy. But they're actually profound because of what you just said. The loving kindness really is unconditional. You know, in our Sangha now, we chant the Karaniya Metta Sutta, you know, almost every time we meet. And there's a reason for that, because it is no easy task to extend that love unconditionally and to keep remembering that that's not based on worth. No one has to do anything to deserve that love. They deserve it simply because they are, because they exist. That does not mean that it in any way justifies or condones somebody's harmful actions. It's like that love, you know, it's like it's the ocean, you know, the water that just fills the ocean. And then we throw trash into it. The water is no less itself. It's no less water in its waterness. Our job is to pick out that trash, to not throw it in the first place, and to pick it out when it's there. We don't hate the trash. We don't even hate the people throwing it, because that's a waste of our energy, our precious energy. So we go in, we take out the trash, we put it where it belongs, and then we work to how do we do this together so we don't fill this ocean with trash? How do we do it? What do we do so that we honor the sacredness of this gift that's been given to us and that we have on loan? We forget, you know, we often act as if this is forever. This isn't forever. And we have it on loan, and we're supposed to be stewards of it. And we don't always do a good job. But that's what I've been saying recently, you know, to really work with our minds to do what will be most effective. And hating another, cultivating ill will for another, aversion for another, will not help anyone. And so the work is to continue to turn in, and be like, how do I cultivate this love? And do what needs to be done. Take care of what needs to be taken care of. So that's why it helps to do it together. May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
And wonderful to meet with you and Sangha, eyebrow to eyebrow. When my brow relaxed this week, Komio's brow relaxed. So,
How do you know her brow relaxed?
Because she's part of my body. And that's just how I feel, your body. That's what I've been experiencing this weekend as a Sangha. I think, just in general, I think Sangha is sort of one of the treasures that can be more difficult to understand. It takes a while. So, and this stream that we're flowing in is also our body. So, I want to be brave and go out and help. I want to help. And I feel like there's things to do that I don't know if I'm that brave, if I can step up.
Mm-hmm.
I've stepped up here. It's helping me do that.
Exactly.
Tarla asked me, how do you know so much about the, you know, the music? I said, I don't, but that's how I know. I got my butt kicked, and I, you know, I did what I did last time, and now I can help someone else do it, really. So, anyway.
I mean, I think what you said is the key, you know, when you realize, you know, Noah is the spleen, and Casey's the liver, and Margarita's the foot, exactly. That we really are one body. And you really begin to feel that in yourself, you take care of each part differently. You know, and we're not always going to be in concert. You know, sometimes we will disagree with one another. Sometimes a moment, you know, a flash of aversion will come up. But when you keep remembering, yes, but this is my body, then you tend to it. The point is not all of us to be the same. That would be horrific, actually. The point is to learn how to live together. Mm-hmm. You know, I say this all the time because it's the question that brought me to practice. How can it be? How can it be what we create? You know, when we were in New York, you know, Kira and I, we went up to the edge as one of those observation platforms. And so you're seeing the whole city. And I was just looking out over it. And it's a feeling I often have in New York City, particularly, of what human beings are capable of. How can that be that we can do that and we still can't figure out how to get along? It boggles my mind. And then we spend a little bit of time together and realize, yes, because we see things differently. We want different things. We don't really, but we think we do. And so then we fight and then we separate and then we look at what is different, what is other. And in our practice, we keep reminding ourselves, yes, we are different. Absolutely. You know, each of us is unique. And we are also one thing. So, let's not forget that. May your life go well.
So Sanchi, as I discussed with you, getting to be your attendant and being part of, you know, in sessions, it clarifies things tremendously. It's just, you know, first I thought, okay, it's about service, but no, it's about noticing and then responding, and that's kind of it. Mm-hmm. And from that flows a life of just seeing, noticing, responding, what needs to be done. And it's, and, you know, feelings of love come and go, anger, none of that is very, matters that much. And, but that's here.
Well, it matters insofar that we do need to acknowledge it, right? So we don't want to suppress anything or ignore anything, but it doesn't have to stop us from responding.
Exactly. And yeah, but because in some ways this time here, it's like a it's like a haiku. You know, you have it's 5, mm-hmm. 7, 5. Now you have freedom because right. It's you have to do it within that. I go, in my life, now I've got, it's like, well, what's the form? You choose. What's it about? You choose. And mm-hmm. and here's all the rope you need to hang yourself. And by God, I do it. And that ability to see and respond simply gets lost in this I, you know, like, well, what am I going to do? What's wrong with me? It becomes a drama instead of like, oh, okay, I made a mistake. Don't do that next time. Doesn't, if I hurt someone, if I let someone down, if I don't have the courage to do something I want, I struggle to bring that into my life every day.
Well, that's why we have all these forms, right? That's why we have the four vows and the four immeasurables and the six paramitas or the 10 paramitas. Yeah, that's why we go over the precepts. That's why we study so that we can gather the tools that we need in our lives. I mean, you know, here it is the easiest of circumstances in one sense, right? But life is coming at you fast and furious. And exactly the question is, how do I stay present and respond and not get lost? So let me ask you the question that I asked Kurt. So how do you save this being right now? You have a being in front of you, and let's say it's this being right now. How do you save them?
I look you in the eye, answer.
Explanation.
Very happy to be here and be sitting here face to face with you.
Say it more succinctly.
I'm caught, I think. I would just more succinctly as I love you.
I love you too. May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
I am here because of sanghas in my life. Sometimes you see me on the screen as OWOW because I'm with six women on a Monday night, the old women of the way.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow. That's right. Yes. And one of them said, you should get Suize as your teacher. Okay. Maybe it's time for that. And that sangha came from another sangha, which came from another sangha. I really don't know what I would do if I was sangha-less, because that's been so, and everybody here, thank you for lifting me, giving me things, hugging me, bringing me chairs, bringing me my table, Curtis. I never thought I would want to have somebody, people wait on me. I would be the one that would wait on other people. And I thought, wow.
Okay. I don't know that they're waiting on you.
Well, I mean,
maybe let's reframe that a little bit.
Somebody said service, okay, I'm service. Helpfulness, caring. It just was so evident. And Usually that's what I give and not get, so I've been getting it, and it's been...
Is it hard?
Very hard. It is.
Why?
So hard.
Because to receive.
Because I guess I didn't feel worthy of that sort of thing. Maybe I would just have to give and not get back, or I was just not connected to the giver. And now it's like I get connected to the giver, and I can be the giver. And it's lovely. It's refreshing. It's love. It's beauty. And it's hard sometimes. But I am just real grateful for sanghas. And then I have a book club, and all of a sudden one of the, they're not Buddhist or trying to be or wanting to be, and one of them said, I think this is our sangha. And I thought, okay, you just make sangha, you know? You make sangha, and it's...
You have two people, and that's the sangha.
Yeah, right, right.
Two people who want to wake up. Mm-hmm. It's not just, you know, two random people, but two people who want to wake up and who want to help each other do that. So here we are doing it.
Thank you. Thank you for your teachings.
May your life
always
go well.
Everybody.
I used to think that unconditional love was only for my children. And the Sangha has really shown me that everybody is perfect.
Why is that funny?
Because it's just a funny statement, but it's so true. I mean, things that I feel like I used to focus on, things that I used to care about, you know, they still come up. But you said last night that the Sangha is really a microcosm of the world. And that's exactly what I have felt all weekend. It's just, this is just a mini version. And all the personalities and you know, again, not talking, but feeling everybody. And it's just been so... profound.
Let me say something about that, because that's really important. You know, that when we're not talking and we can really feel one another, you know, there's so little silence in most of our lives right now. And it's not that we don't feel. We're constantly picking up each other, and we're certainly picking up our own minds, but it doesn't register because we're just rushing by.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, what happens is we then react, and we don't even know what we're reacting to.
Mm-hmm.
And so here, things kind of get slowed down, they get more visible, and we're able to see, oh, this person did this, and I responded in this way. Oh, I tend to respond in this way to this particular kind of thing. Oh, I wonder if there's another way of doing this.
And you also can't fall into your usual ways of dealing with things. You know, even
exactly.
losing my voice on the car ride up here and driving you all was very unusual for me not to be able to talk. So it was like, I feel like I had a jump start on, you know, being silent and figuring out, like, how to be. It was even more challenging to be with people that were talking and telling stories. And I had all these things I wanted to say, and I couldn't say anything. But it was also very beautiful, because I really just was listening, and I was extremely present. And sometimes when we're talking, we're not as present. So it was really actually kind of a gift, I think. But I love the Sangha. And it's a community that I cherish.
Yeah. And I just want to say something about the silence again, you know, that because sometimes we could perceive it as, oh, there's this thing I have to do when I come to something like Sesshin. And it's not like that. You know, we're creating a container. It's not about the discipline of it. It's that we're creating a container so we can feel one another, so we can feel ourselves. And so it's not, you know, don't be on your phone and don't talk to each other because Sesshin is what, silence is what we do in Sesshin. It's be close to yourself, right? And that when we do need to talk, that we're able to reflect for a moment, do I need to say this? Do I need to actually express something right now? Can I just be with this myself?
Yeah, it's work.
When I'm giving instruction, how much instruction do I give? Is it timely? Is it necessary? Is it beneficial? Is it kind? Which one am I missing? True. Is it true? Yes. Exactly. Exactly. So, it's like we have, and this is, you know, it's been what, 2.5 days, really, and we have this mirror that is held up. And sometimes, you know, I think I've said this to you, sometimes it gets a little harder before it gets easier because you start to see so much. And it can be a little overwhelming, or it can be sobering, or it can be embarrassing. It's like, my God, do I do that? And then you realize, yes, I do that. Now I can do something about it. And we continue. And there's so much acceptance, I feel, you know, that comes as we continue to take, you know, we take that step and we take another step. We realize, oh, I am this way. And that's okay. That is perfectly okay. May your life go well. We'll do maybe just a couple more.
I really want to be able to unreservedly rely on others and really, like, you know, let myself fall apart and other people put me back together. But I'm finding it hard. Like, I'm finding that I, even when I don't feel like I have a lot of capacity to be self-sufficient, like, that I'm, and even if I'm in little ways, letting myself really need others, letting others help me, there's still a feeling of like, okay, but that's just a little, letting a little bit out, and the rest I'm holding it really tight together.
Why?
I mean, I can't, and I don't know that I've ever not done that, maybe since I was like a baby. Mm-hmm. And it's, I don't really know, what that is, or and I guess there's a fear of like, what if I'm falling and waiting for everyone to catch me and put me back on my feet, and they don't.
Yeah. So key to unreservedly rely on, to throw oneself, is what we do when we take refuge, right, in the three treasures. And I understand, I can relate. And in, you know, in my sample of one, in my own lived experience, but then also what I have seen is that, you know, life at certain points will ask more of us than we think we're able to hold. And so out of, you know, perhaps exhaustion or desperation or confusion, it falls apart. It's not even that you do anything. It just, the whole thing falls apart. And, you know, it's interesting that you said, you know, waiting for someone to come forward. Because I don't know, I think that's where the fear comes from. You know, the expectation or the question, will they? But what I have found is that it's not actually quite like that. It's much more immediate. It falls apart, but the way life is built, the way that it works, is that there's no way for it to come back together unless it's done together. It might not be the people that you thought who will help you up. It might not be the events that you thought, you know, that will help you get back on your feet. But life is constantly, there's that Rilke line, life holds you in its hand and it won't let you go, something like that. That has been my experience. And so that trust, I think comes really out of that moment of surrender. It's like there's a point at which you have no choice but to trust something more than just you. And life holds you. So I hope that you will see that.
Thank you.
May your life go well.
I went to a coffee shop this week, and there was a baby in a stroller, and next to this baby in a stroller was a dad working on who I assumed was this baby's dad, working on a laptop, a very liberal, progressive town. He was clean-cut, looked like a yuppie, and he had a holster on his chest, and the holster had a We the People patch, and then an SPQR patch, the Senate and the Populace of Rome, which has been co-opted by white nationalists recently. And it made me see red. It made me want to act out not compassionately, not peacefully. In a way that I would have done damage to both this person and to myself. And, you know, I don't know if the only thing that stopped me, but one of the things that stopped me was like, well, you know, this baby isn't at fault for anything. So I'm not going to reason with this person. There's no way to reason somebody out of something they have not been reasoned into. And over the course of the day that followed and the next day, I tried to generate compassion for this person. I tried to ask myself, well, what kind of lessons has this person been getting all their life? Like, what kind of experiences have they had? Difficult experiences, traumatic experiences, to make them want to identify with hatred, with separation. And that doesn't feel... I understand about the value of there is no other and there is no I, and that is the value in seeing the Sangha as the Buddha. But how do you include this person in that Sangha, in that Buddhahood?
Yeah. Well, no one is exempted. No one is outside of that Buddhahood. And so the choices that any one of us make throughout our lives don't exclude us, you know, for the potential of awakening. We might not get there. Some of us may not get there. But that person ultimately wants the same thing that I want. They want to be safe, and they want their family to be safe. They want to be free to live in the way that... they feel will bring them well-being. They want to be happy. And so to remember that, you know, to bring that to mind, sati, is to be mindful, to remember that the person in front of you is also a Buddha. Again, does not in any way condone somebody's actions if the way that they're acting is harmful. But the basis... The ground on which we are all walking is that wakefulness, at least according to Buddhism. And so as a practitioner, you know, my responsibility is to work with my mind. So in that moment and in every moment that follows, I don't compound the suffering that we already see in the world, but that I do even something as simple as say to that person in my mind, may you be safe, may you be kind, may you be joyful, may you be awake. I feel that it is my responsibility, you know, to not make things worse, to help and not harm. And so I cannot change, and I do not want to change another's way of life. I don't want to change their beliefs, just as I don't want somebody to tell me what to do with my body, who to marry. And so in my own life and in the choices that I make, I will train my mind and I will live my life in such a way that I don't add to that suffering. May your life go well. Maybe last one. Okay, two. And you can go after Elliot.
Shosanji. So you open this with the next Buddha, maybe will be a Buddha of community. Where isn't the body of this Buddha?
Where isn't? Exactly. Can you find that place?
No place.
Right. And so what does that mean?
I was
what
not...
does that mean, for example, for what Hogetsu just said?
Well, you just said, not how do you not compound this harm? Mm-hmm. And I immediately saw how I was compounding that harm with friends of mine, that I will have that bickering. Maybe we don't have the same political beliefs. Mm-hmm. But in our self-righteousness, we can create that barrier where we create that separation that we vowed not to create.
Well, you know my phrase, I would rather be free than be right.
Amen.
And, you know, again, it does not have to... particularly when we're with family, when we're with friends, you know, the climate now has separated families, has created rifts in friendships. And somebody said something very interesting. Who was it? This week, friends of ours were saying, you know, I think it was Kira's friend, we are arguing about people who don't know anything about us. We will never meet them. They don't know about our lives. And you and I are not talking to each other because of them? That's insane. And the other person was like, oh, you're right. Okay, so then let's find a way to be together. We have to find a way to be together. And yes, it's definitely getting harder because of all the rifts that we're creating that are not there. They are not there fundamentally. That's why it doesn't work. That's why violence as a response to violence doesn't work, because it doesn't end. And so, again, I do feel very much that our responsibility, you know, we're working to see a little more, to act with clarity, to act with wisdom and compassion. That is our vow. That's our imperative. At the cash register in the supermarket, at the person who cuts you off in their car, the person you sit down at the table with, and they have views that you may find abhorrent even. Okay, in that moment, how do you save that being? And it does not, saving, we know, is not what we think normally. It is not changing them. It is not fixing them. It is to meet them completely. May your life go well.
Thank you for your teachings.
Should I use the mic?
Yes, please.
One of the most powerful insights I ever had, which I'd forgotten for a couple of years somewhat, is that it doesn't have to be this way.
What's the this?
Whatever this is. If it's this house being a house, if it's us having a loving sangha, if it's the world in chaos, Nothing has to be the way it is unless anything, anyone can become Buddha. There's a stoplight, a walk signal at my school that's been broken for the past 2 months or so. And I realize I'm going to keep pressing that button, see if it comes on and turns to the walk signal. Because I believed that it would stay that way, because I'd seen it that way for enough time to convince me that it was real and solid. But I have faith that either it will get destroyed or one day the walk light will come on. It can't stay that way. Doesn't mean it'll get better, but it can't stay that way.
Right.
And
impermanence is a hard teaching. It's not comfortable, right, in any shape or form. And it is the way things are. I mean, it's really the only constant in our lives, is that inconstancy, is that change.
And so in my own family, and some of people share with me their family, people change, and sometimes for the drastically worse, and that's what we see in this society right now. And that can't be who they are, nor could the state, the politics they had 10 years ago that were better be who they were.
And people also change for the better.
Right. And so one of the things I was thinking was Angulimala when we were talking about this. Now, we were once strangers. We weren't once a loving family. We were once strangers, which even you had doubts about if we could really do it. But how do you save a forest? You plant a few seeds, and then maybe a forest could come. I can't save you or anyone else, but you can give someone a fishing net that they can be a fish that jumps into the net if they want to be.
Yeah. But what does this have to do with Angulimala? You know, who was tasked to kill 1,000 people, and then he would make a garland of fingers?
He killed 999, so correct. The story goes, and he became fully enlightened. And people hated him for the rest of his life because they thought, this isn't fair. Why could a person who murdered 999 people become fully enlightened? And so who are we to say?
But hold on. Why did he become fully enlightened?
The big question that you asked us, how does our suffering now erase our karma of the past?
Mm-hmm.
From what I remember, the Buddha asked him to give refuge to someone. He didn't think he was worthy of doing it. He repented so sincerely, and everywhere he went, people would stone him, and he just kept practicing.
Right. You know, so the story goes, like he was ahimsaka. He was the one who did not harm.
Right, originally.
And he got tricked, you know, by his teacher,
his jealous teacher.
And so he starts killing people and becomes, so this is the poignancy of the story, he becomes the monster through his actions, through the killing. He can no longer even remember who he is. And then he sees first his mother walking by, and he decides, okay, well, she's the last one. But then somebody had told the Buddha about him. So the Buddha walks by with his crony, Ananda, and says, okay, I'll kill him instead. And he starts running after the Buddha, right? He starts chasing him. And the Buddha's just calmly walking by. And as fast as Angulimala is running, he cannot catch up to the Buddha. And so he yells to him. He's like, stop! And the Buddha turns and says, Angulimala, I have stopped. It's you who haven't stopped. And that's the moment when he realizes what he's done. And he falls to the ground. He falls apart. He falls apart, starts crying, realizing what he has done, and asks the Buddha to ordain him. And so the Buddha does, and he picks him up. And when the people are stoning him, he becomes a shramana. He becomes a monastic. And when the people are stoning him and pelting him with sticks and insulting him, the Buddha says, bear this. Shramana, bear this suffering, because it is what will turn your past karma. So to me, the fact that afterwards he becomes enlightened is a little bit like cherry on the cake. It's that moment when he realizes what he's done and he repents. to me, that's the moment. That's the whole thing in the story. And as I said last night, every moment is like that. Every moment, no matter what you have done, in every moment is the potential to see, to repent, to turn, and to start again. Isn't that incredible? May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
So the next Buddha may take the form of a community. Community practicing, understanding, and loving kindness, mindful living. We don't have to know deep philosophical Buddhist teachings to create a Buddha field. You know, we don't have to know doctrine to be respectful, to be kind. We do have to put effort into being awake, to be present, to be caring, because life comes at us fast. And so we have to learn to slow down enough to see, you know, to hear, to really feel, in order to build what I call the ethics of care. Louis Massignon, who was a scholar of Islam, called it the science of compassion. You put yourself in another's shoes, but you really, it's more than that. You enter another's life, another's mind, so you can see life as they do, you can feel life as they do, and from there, you respond with care. This is what we're doing. You know, every time you let go of a thought, you return to your breath. Every time you ask yourself, what is mu? What is a cypress tree? What you're doing is getting out of the way so that the world can see through your eyes. You know, Dada Roshi used to say that what we do, that our practice, may be the most important thing we can do with our lives. I think he's right. May your life go well.
For more talks, to get more information about Zuise's teaching, or to join her email list, visit us at oceanmindsangha.org.